Chapter 17. It's a leadership problem. In February 2020, California Governor Gavin Newsom dedicated most of his annual State of the State address to California's homelessness crisis. "Let's call it what it is," Newsom said. "A disgrace that the richest state in the richest nation, succeeding across so many sectors, is failing to properly house, heal, and humanely treat so many of its own people." Between 2010 and 2020, the number of homeless rose by 31% in California, but declined 19% in the rest of the United States. As a result, there were, as of 2020, at least 161,000 total homeless people in California, with about 114,000 of them unsheltered, sleeping in tents on sidewalks, in parks, and alongside highways. Homelessness had become the number one issue in the state. Half of all California voters surveyed said they saw homeless people on the street 5 times a week. 3/4 said the problem had worsened. People close to Newsom told me that he knew he had to make progress on solving homelessness if he were to be a serious candidate for the presidency. Newsom said he knew from personal experience what worked. 15 years ago, when I was mayor of San Francisco, in the face of long odds and stiff opposition, we established Project Homeless Connect to bring local government services directly to people. It has been wildly successful and adopted in 250 cities. "I don't think homelessness can be solved," said Newsom. "I know homelessness can be solved." After he finished, lawmakers from both parties stood and applauded. Newsom appeared to make good on his commitment in April 2020 by helping San Francisco and other California cities use federal stimulus funding to rent hotel rooms for the homeless to shelter in place during the COVID-19 pandemic, an initiative called Project Room Key. Doing so was an obvious win-win-win for hotel owners who could have been bankrupted by the pandemic, for the homeless who were uniquely vulnerable to the spread of COVID-19, and for the public. Jennifer Friedenbach of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness praised Newsom, whom she had criticized fiercely over the years, telling National Public Radio, "I'm a big believer in redemption." Newsom appears to understand that addiction and mental illness are core drivers of homelessness, and to genuinely care about the problem and the people impacted by it. For over 20 years, Newsom has walked the streets of San Francisco and other California cities, deliberated with experts for hundreds, if not thousands, of hours, and interacted with countless homeless people. Newsom personally escorted psychiatrist Ken Rosenberg into the Los Angeles County Jail to witness the mentally ill inmates in their plexiglass cells. "The state of mental illness in this country is beyond the trite notion of crisis," Newsom told Rosenberg. "It's at a point of comedic absurdity." And in his February 2020 State of the State address, Newsom called for more conservatorship, noting that some are capable of accepting help to get off the streets and into treatment in the first place, but some tragically are not. But he has not been honest with the public and perhaps with himself about the problem. Newsom pointed to a specific San Francisco initiative, Project Homeless Connect, which he claimed was wildly successful. "I frequently saw advocates do the same, pointing to programs they claimed were successful despite the overall problem getting worse. Doing so is understandable. People need to believe in something. But it misses the big picture of what is causing the failure and what will fix it." California's Independent Legislative Analyst's Office said something similar when it evaluated Newsom's proposals. "We find the governor's budget proposal falls short of articulating a clear strategy for curbing homelessness in California," it wrote. Now, there is evidence that the response to COVID-19 by progressive cities, including San Francisco, made the addiction crisis worse. Before the pandemic, many street addicts would be occasionally arrested and forced to detox and get clean for a few days or weeks, but during the pandemic, many remained intoxicated without interruption, worsening their addictions. "Morgan was really into meth," said Kelly Stamphill, who tracked down her fentanyl-addicted son in a Tenderloin-safe sleeping site in March 2021. "When I walked through there, it's mind-bogglingly scary. I'm on his Instagram page and saw that he said to one of his friends, 'I'm more addicted than I've ever been.'" And because Newsom remains committed to housing first, he failed to seize the opportunity to get addicts into recovery. Instead, he and other California leaders gave away free hotel rooms without asking anything in return. "They've missed so many opportunities," said San Francisco's Vicky Westbrook. "They've had people in these shelter-in-place hotels. Why, instead of giving them alcohol and all the drug paraphernalia, not offer them drug treatment groups? Like, we're giving you these hotels, but we're also going to have case managers come around and talk to you about sobriety. But no, nothing. And now, of course, the homeless don't want to leave these hotels. I get that alcohol withdrawal is a serious thing, but I'm going to put you in a hotel, I'm going to feed you, I'm going to do your laundry, and I'm giving you booze. Like, who would leave?" When city workers offered one group of shelter-in-place hotel residents placements in a newly renovated permanent supportive housing facility in early 2021, two-thirds turned down the offer, likely because the hotel rooms were free and had private instead of communal bathrooms. San Francisco city government had also, during the pandemic, created safe sleeping sites where the homeless could pitch tents to social distance. The city spent $61,000 per tent, which is 2.5 times the median rent for a one-bedroom apartment in the city. The program served 262 homeless people. The city turned Civic Center Plaza and several empty lots in the Tenderloin into sites. In the spring of 2021, Supervisor Raphael Mandelman introduced legislation to require the homeless to stay either in a shelter or, if there is no shelter space available, in a tent at a safe sleeping site. Jennifer Friedenbach of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness denounced the proposal as cruel, writing that the author has often talked about it as a way to justify the criminalization of homeless folks through enforcement of anti-homeless laws such as SITLI. Progressive supervisor Matt Haney blasted safe sleeping sites, reported the Chronicle, saying they were a failed approach. In the end, Mandelman found little support for his proposal. San Francisco reaffirmed its decriminalization of public camping, and progressives remained more in charge of the city's response to crime, drugs, and homelessness than ever before. What explains Newsom's commitment to a failing status quo? "The people who bear the consequences aren't the same ones who set the policy," said Keith Humphreys. "You can sit in the suburbs and feel smug about the fact that you oppose the war on drugs and have a Black Lives Matter sign in your yard, but you don't have homeless people taking a crap on your front stoop every day, or have all your packages stolen every single day. When you're in a city, as Gavin used to be, the cost of this stuff is more evident to you than it is from 50,000 feet. And he would endure great political blowback from lots of people who support him, who don't see the downsides and feel very good about the current policy." The American Civil Liberties Union, the Harm Reduction Coalition, and Housing First advocates exercise significant influence over elected leaders. One of Newsom's homelessness advisors, Philip F. Mangano, told me that the governor feared lawsuits by the American Civil Liberties Union if he sought to expand mandatory treatment of the mentally ill and addicted. "Gavin is a check-the-box kind of Democrat," a political consultant in Sacramento told me. "Crossing powerful Democratic Party interest groups is simply not in the interest of someone who wants to be president." One important reason homelessness must be addressed at the state level is the high level of transience among the homeless. As we saw, at least 30% of San Francisco homeless said they were homeless before coming to the city, and stricter and smaller towns displace difficult populations to larger and more liberal cities. There is a lack of shelter, housing, and services throughout our country, said Los Angeles service provider Joel John Roberts. So if a person is forced into another community that is deficient of services, what makes you think they will stay? If they have already found a safe hiding place under a bridge, in the bushes along the freeway, or in a park, they will return to their haven, said Mandelman. I don't think it can be solved at the county level. Mental health advocate John Snook agreed. Every community has been allowed to build smokescreens and pawn things off on the next county. Neither governors nor mayors directly oversee many mental health services and instead give contracts to nonprofit organizations. They are thus unable to hold the mental health system accountable. A big part of the reason for the failure of the homeless industrial complex has had to do with perverse incentives, progressive resistance to mandatory treatment, and the insistence on permanent supportive housing over shelters. But it also has to do with the neoliberal model of outsourcing services. Instead of governments providing such services directly, they give grants to nonprofit service providers who are unaccountable for their performance. There is no statutory requirement for government to address homelessness, complained University of Pennsylvania researcher Dennis Culhane. It's mainly the domain of a bunch of charities who are unlicensed, unfunded, relatively speaking, run by unqualified people who do a shitty job. There's no formal government responsibility. It's only something we dream of. And that is fundamentally part of the problem. Nobody can even accurately calculate how much money is being spent. The state auditor calculates that California spends $12 billion total on homelessness, and it is not clear how much of that is overlap with other state spending. The legislative analyst's office found many difficulties. Difficulty assessing how much the state is spending on a particular approach towards addressing homelessness, for example, prevention versus intervention efforts, difficulty determining how programs work collaboratively, difficulty assessing what programs are collectively accomplishing. Said Vicky Westbrook, "Sometimes I think there are too many nonprofits. You don't know which one to go with. Maybe it matters and maybe it doesn't. Maybe they're providing exactly the same services. Maybe they say they are, but they're not doing it in the same way." Thomas Insel agreed that the state needed to make sweeping reforms. But, he said, "Everybody says the same thing to me. You're going to have to change the Constitution because the way that we got to where we are was through a series of ballot measures." But that's not as daunting a challenge as it may seem. California governors raise money and pass ballot initiatives all the time, as they did over the last two decades when they liberalized drug laws. Why wasn't Newsom doing that? After Insel somewhat half-heartedly pointed to COVID-19 and the subsequent recall campaign, I scowled. He knew as well as I did that Newsom had been governor for more than a year before the pandemic and had been lieutenant governor and mayor for 15 years before that. Insel didn't criticize Newsom directly, but when I read the transcript from our interview, I was struck by how often he returned to one theme in particular. "It's been really hard to get any real leadership," Insel said. "I don't think money is the problem. I think it's the leadership. We need state leadership. There's no state leadership. We have to create state leadership. I don't think it's a money problem. I think it's a leadership problem." In 2019, Newsom convened another homelessness task force, pledging to appoint a homelessness czar to oversee the program. In early 2021, I asked a member of the governor's task force, Jeff Belisario of the Bay Area Council, an influential business advocacy group, if it had created a plan to end homelessness. "No," said Belisario. "What about a proposal to just shelter people?" "There's a lot of power in Sacramento on the housing first side," said Belisario, "and few people talking about shelter. Housing First has taken over a lot of what happens on the ground, whether in the nonprofits or cities and counties. In the end, we ended up with nothing. In May 2021, Governor Newsom unveiled a plan to spend another $12 billion to confront the homelessness crisis head-on, supposedly demanding more accountability and urgency from service providers. But he again missed the point. Newsom's new plan promises to increase housing placements and treatment beds for those with behavioral health problems. But there is no indication of how he will ensure that people use those services. As such, he is doubling down on the exact same solutions that have contributed to the growing homelessness crisis in California over the last decade. Said Snook in 2020, "I'm always cynical about California. You've had lots of opportunities for this to happen over the last 25 years with a lot of the same people." It is not hard to imagine what an aggressive response from the White House would look like, not just on rising overdose deaths, but also rising homicides. The president and vice president would make heavy use of the bully pulpit, meeting with family members of victims, giving speeches, and funding millions of dollars in public service advertising. They would warn of the dangers of fentanyl and other hard drugs, demand national action to reduce violence, overdose deaths, and homicides, and inspire America around a vision and strategy to reverse the rise in overdose deaths and homicides. And they would pressure the states to step up mandatory medically assisted drug treatment, break up the open-air drug markets, and expand conservatorship and assisted outpatient treatment for the mentally ill. In early 2021, momentum appeared to be building for the White House to take aggressive action on the drug addiction, overdose, and poisoning crisis. Humphreys and other experts publicly urged President Joe Biden to take strong measures. In July, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced there had been more than 93,000 overdose and poisoning deaths in 2020. A few days later, President Biden's son, Hunter Biden, published a memoir describing his crack addiction, which revealed poignant moments between father and son as Hunter spiraled downward. But by mid-2021, little had been done. They have just issued expanding rules for MDs, as well as physician assistants and nurse practitioners, to prescribe buprenorphine, Suboxone, Humphreys said. And they also have $4 billion to give out in grants this year. It is notable that the highest-profile action the Biden White House had taken relating to drugs and crime was to deny employment to some low-level White House staffers who admitted to having smoked marijuana in the past. The decision was viewed by many progressives and conservatives alike as bizarre, given the marijuana and cocaine use acknowledged by former President Barack Obama and the marijuana use acknowledged by Vice President Kamala Harris. Noted Humphreys, "There is no confirmed head at the Office of National Drug Control Policy, FDA or DEA, and the president has said little about the epidemic to date." How and why do progressives ruin cities? So far, we have explored six reasons. They divert funding from homeless shelters to permanent supportive housing, resulting in insufficient shelter space. They defend the right of people they characterize as victims to camp on sidewalks, in parks, and along highways, as well as to break other laws, including against public drug use and defecation. They intimidate experts, policymakers, and journalists by attacking them as being motivated by a hatred of the poor, people of color, and the sick, and as causing violence against them. They reduce penalties for shoplifting, drug dealing, and public drug use. They prefer homelessness and incarceration to involuntary hospitalization for the mentally ill and addicted. And their ideology blinds them to the harms of harm reduction, housing first, and camp anywhere policies, leading them to misattribute the addiction, untreated mental illness, and homeless crisis to poverty and to policies and politicians dating back to the 1980s. But progressives are defined in opposition to moderate Democrats and Republicans, and so our explanation is incomplete. To understand why progressives ruin cities, we have to understand why they have been able to maintain and increase their political control of them over the last 30 years, despite the reality on the ground. Democrats sometimes say progressivism is inextricable from the identities and ethos of California and Washington State. San Francisco was the center of that progressive liberal ethos, said former San Francisco Mayor Art Agnos. I think it begins with the origins of the city and the gold rush. Washington State's history is marked by a progressive ethos, wrote a Seattle historian. Movements like social legislation, labor laws, and woman suffrage, spanning from the state's founding, are all part of Washington's enduring progressive impulse. But conservatism and republicanism used to be so prevalent that California and Washington were both considered swing states. In fact, between 1948 and 1988, both states were more Republican than the rest of the country. Washington State voted for a Democratic candidate in just two presidential elections in those 40 years, while California voted Democrat just once, in Lyndon Johnson's landslide 1964 victory. Between 1943 and 1998, Republicans held the California governorship for 41 years, interrupted only by Pat Brown and his son Jerry Brown, who had 2 4-year terms each. The state's legislative branches were more closely contested. Democrats and Republicans handed off control equally in the post-Cold War era. The move toward progressivism in California and Washington can be explained by shifts in the party's postures and shifts in voter demographics. After the end of the Cold War, the federal government decommissioned superfluous military bases on the West Coast. As part of this peace dividend, many military families and contractors who reliably voted for Republicans left California and Washington for cheap real estate and new employment in the fast-growing Sunbelt states. Simultaneously, an influx of Latin American immigrants was arriving in California, and many Latinos were put off by Republican Governor Pete Wilson's support of Proposition 187, which blocked access to public benefits for undocumented immigrants. At the same time, the nascent tech industry was attracting a new professional class that emerged from the 60s counterculture. To them, the Republican Party was seen as culturally and ideologically tied to establishment. The new class of tech entrepreneurs and engineers instead flocked to the Democratic Party, which increasingly promoted pro-business policies alongside a social and cultural progressivism. Meanwhile, conservatives ceded the issue of homelessness to progressives. I asked Christopher Rufo, a leading critic of harm reduction and Housing First, why that was. Most Republican policymakers don't actually care about the issue of homelessness because it doesn't affect their districts, he said. Any urban district, especially on the West Coast, is pretty much a 100% democratically controlled area. Republican legislators from the eastern side of California or rural districts have a limited, look at the feces-covered West Coast cities, the libs are ruining everything view. They don't really feel like they need a plan, and they don't really care what happens in San Francisco or LA or Seattle. Some conservatives uncritically embraced Housing First because they had failed to develop their own solutions to the problem. Said the economist Wayne Weingarten, the left will tell you what the government should be doing, but the right is very squished. What is the government's responsibility? Should we be running institutions that help people who have drug addictions and mental illness? You don't have that debate on the right. It is all about, we want less government and lower taxes. The question is, what should we be spending, and what should it be on? And I think the right, if it's really going to rebuild itself, needs to have definitive answers to those questions. Part of the power of harm reduction, said Stephen Ide of the Center-Right Manhattan Institute, is that it can be viewed as conservative. Some people might say it's just a small government philosophy, said Ide. Government just can't change behavior, so we should focus on what government can do, which is hand out needles, create supervised injection facilities, and teach sex ed instead of making people be abstinent. Many on the left and right embraced drug decriminalization and even legalization for libertarian reasons. George Soros told Ethan Nadelman he opposed drug prohibition because, as a business person and economist, he saw the absurdity of trying to ban a popular commodity. As a result, in the name of freedom for the victims of mental illness, we have today abdicated our responsibility to properly care for people. A person's choice to bang her head in a subsidized apartment, to drink himself into a stupor, or to sit idly might easily be reframed, noted the sociologist who contrasted drug treatment in Malibu to that in Skid Row. As the state's abdication of responsibility for profound need and social defeat. If California were to provide a $500,000 studio apartment unit to each of its 150,000 homeless people, the cost would be $75 billion. The cost of providing services, at a cost of $25,000 per person, would be an additional $3.75 billion annually. Thus, over a 30-year period, the total cost would be about $187.5 billion in 2020 dollars, or $6.2 billion annualized. What if the cost per unit ended up being $750,000, rather than $500,000, as they ended up being in the Bay Area and Los Angeles? The cost would be $225 billion in 2020 dollars over a 30-year period, or $7.5 billion annualized. Let's say California spent half that amount and spent the other half on lower-cost residential homes and shelters to bring the cost down to $6 billion. And let's say that the federal government paid for half, to account for the fact that California has half of America's homeless, but just 12% of the population. That would bring total annual costs down to $3 billion, which is just one quarter of what California currently spends in a year on homelessness. Could California afford it? Of course. If the money for housing could not come from existing pools of money, would voters support increasing the total budget by 2% or $3 billion annually to build the basic shelter and housing for the homeless? It is conceivable. Recall that California as a whole spent $13.3 billion on homelessness between fiscal years 2018 and 2021, beyond the $1.25 billion San Francisco spent on homelessness in the same period. And homelessness remains the number one issue in the minds of voters, who are fed up and want a solution to the problem. But what can be done to prevent the homeless population from simply replenishing itself? And where and how could California build all the new apartments, residential homes, and shelters? For the last two decades, San Francisco and other progressive cities have sought to become more livable and walkable, including through expansive greenbelts surrounding cities, but without building significantly more housing. Since the 1960s, progressives have criticized suburban housing for breeding conformity and urban redevelopment for displacing poor people of color. They have demanded large protected areas around cities where housing is prohibited. And they have demanded greater power at the neighborhood level, empowering Not In My Backyard, NIMBY, activists across the state. By 1987, progressives had put 24 no-growth referendums on municipal ballots in California. 20 passed. In Redwood City, south of San Francisco, anti-growth arsonists burned down single-family homes under construction in 20 separate locations after the city council lifted a moratorium on new home construction. In California, Bay Area cities, including San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, and Southern California cities, including Los Angeles, Santa Monica, and West Hollywood, all imposed rent control. The only major cities in California that rejected it were San Diego and Sacramento. Local governments in California are able to reject new housing even when it complies with zoning rules. More than 80% of all lawsuits filed under the state's 1970 California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, are against urban infill housing, not new development in natural areas. As a result, California has the second highest cost of living in the country, behind only Hawaii, with just a handful of lucky people benefiting from rent control. 43% of California voters and 61% of those aged 18 to 34 said in 2019 that they couldn't afford to live in the state. One-third of Californians say they have seriously considered moving out of the state entirely due to housing costs. Few people are aware of how unfair rent control has become. We have people making $500,000 plus in rent-controlled apartments all over town, tweeted Michelle Tandler. In SF, we have surgeons living in Atherton subletting out their med school apartments. How is this equitable? Newsom campaigned and was elected on a pledge to build 500,000 new units of housing every year from 2019 to 2025. But California's housing production declined in both of the years Newsom has been in office, 2019 and 2020. New housing construction in 2020 declined 10%, with just 100,550 new building permits issued, one-fifth of what Newsom had promised. But the trend started long before Newsom. For over a century, California added 300,000 new residents a year on average, expanding faster than any other state. California increased its population by half as much between 2000 and 2020, 17%, as it did between 1980 and 2000, 43%. In 2019, the state gained just 90,846 residents, an increase of 0.2%. In 2021, California lost a congressional seat due to its stagnation relative to other states. Opposition to new housing has ideological roots. American progressives went from optimism in the 1950s about making middle-class living standards attainable for all Americans and overcoming the legacy of racism to deep pessimism just 20 years later. The pessimistic discourse on both the environment and on social progress has been the basis for much of the supposedly progressive opposition to new housing since the 1970s. But NIMBYism also benefits homeowners. By restricting development, property owners reduce supply and drive up prices. Such a strategy is obviously inconsistent with liberal and progressive values, since it hurts poor and working people the most. And so progressive San Franciscans have justified their NIMBYism by insisting that more housing actually hurts the poor, particularly poor people of color. They point to cases of badly done redevelopment, such as the bulldozing of San Francisco's historically African-American neighborhood, the Fillmore, as proof. Over the last decade, demand for new housing in San Francisco and around the country has come from urban millennial professionals who have formed a Yes in My Backyard, YIMBY, movement to counter NIMBYs. In early 2018, State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco introduced YIMBY-backed legislation that would have radically increased the number of apartments, condos, and duplexes near train and bus stations across California. The year before, the California legislature had passed Wiener's legislation to streamline residential housing approvals. But his new legislation was stronger. It would have changed zoning to allow apartments in half of all single-family neighborhoods in Los Angeles, and nearly 100% of them in San Francisco. Opponents of the legislation accused Wiener of proposing a takeover of something that had in the past been controlled locally. The Los Angeles City Council opposed the legislation unanimously. Wiener responded that local control had failed to keep up with demand. In education and healthcare, Wiener noted, the state sets basic standards, and local control exists within those standards. Only in housing has the state abdicated its role. Laura Foote, the executive director of YIMBY Action, a grassroots pro-housing group that supported the bill, agreed. If we make the decisions at the neighborhood level, we're always going to have a collective action problem because there are too many incentives to say the next town over should build the housing. Wiener's boldness inspired left-of-center reporters and columnists. Over the next several months, they penned optimistic articles and columns for the New York Times, Atlantic, Bloomberg Opinion, and other national news media outlets. Newsom appeared to endorse Wiener's idea as he campaigned for governor in 2018, on a promise to create 3.5 million housing units, or 700,000 per year, between 2019 and 2023. I, too, was swept up in the youthful, idealistic passion of the progressive pro-housing YIMBY and its demands for radical increases in housing. But by spring 2019, Wiener's legislation was in trouble. Opponents said it would result in high-rise buildings in residential neighborhoods. Wiener responded by reducing the maximum height in transit-rich areas to 4 or 5 stories. He also agreed to exempt from his bill areas near bus stops that had infrequent service outside of rush hour. None of it was enough. The committee killed Wiener's bill in a 6-4 vote. Wiener introduced an updated version later in 2019, which similarly failed. In response, the leadership of the legislature, where Democrats hold a supermajority, moved Wiener out of any leadership role on housing legislation. A group of 7 legislators formed a moderate alternative to Wiener and the YIMBYs on one side, and NIMBY legislators on the other. The goal was to build consensus around policy that could pass in 2020. YIMBY leaders were optimistic in spring 2020, even after the coronavirus pandemic had begun, that they would pass legislation. COVID has revealed the fragility of housing scarcity and has made it more urgent for us to not exacerbate it, a pro-housing leader who asked to remain anonymous told me. Something inspired by Wiener's legislation, SB 50, will ram through. But nothing of significance did. Opposition to new housing is strong at state and local levels. The average home value in my district is $1.7 million, and I want it to stay that way, an influential Democratic state senator from Southern California reportedly told a pro-housing leader. Said a homelessness advocate, Gavin worries he can't do anything as governor because of opposition to building shelters by mayors. Nobody wants to build more housing, no one. How do you mandate local politicians to do housing? They don't want to, or they'll be voted out of office. Pro-housing leaders said Newsom could have withheld money from the counties that did not build more housing. I think that it's no secret that Gavin's administration has not followed through on what would have been necessary to actually achieve the housing goals that he set forth when he was running for office, said Foote. He didn't put a lot of pressure on the state legislature to pass some of the packages that needed, and they needed a governor to push and usher them through. A pro-housing leader in Sacramento who wished to stay anonymous agreed. He has the inherent legal authority. He just lacks the courage to use it. At this point, the person started laughing. Why are you laughing? I asked. Because there is no other way to say it than the rude way. He is being a coward about it. I would be the same if I were running for president. It takes a certain kind of leader to raise his middle finger, and I don't know if Gavin is the kind of leader to do the right thing when it's unpopular. He's more reactive and transactional. I don't know why he has that political strategy. I would just categorize it as he doesn't because he's afraid to, and it's not more complicated than that. The obstacle for YIMBYs and others who want to require that cities build more housing in existing neighborhoods is not lack of democracy, but too much democracy. California's likely voters tend to be older NIMBY homeowners. Californians over the age of 55 are 1/3 of the adult population, but nearly half of voters. Young people aged 18 to 34 are 1/3 of adults, but 22% of likely voters. Just 1 out of 5 likely voters has no college education, and 2/3 of likely voters are homeowners, while just 1/3 are renters. It's the worst possible opponent because it's big voter, said the pro-housing advocate, laughing. Big voter doesn't want you to succeed. Big voter appears to be the biggest obstacle YIMBYs face in San Francisco. In November 2020, SF Weekly reported that San Francisco's Progressive Board of Supervisors blocked a nominee to the city's transportation board simply because the person was a member of SF YIMBY. Wrote the Weekly, YIMBY has become politically toxic among progressives. Even so, YIMBYs keep pursuing the right message for progressives. They promote more housing for greater livability and walkability. They emphasize solving climate change by reducing driving. And they point to remedying historic racism. Maybe we can get enough people to believe that ending systemic racism is important, said Foote, and therefore we have to reform our land use policies. Maybe, or maybe California's progressives will keep voting NIMBY and assuage whatever guilt they feel by supporting more funding for the homeless, voting for candidates who promise to defund the police, and putting Black Lives Matter signs in their windows.